Welcome to the Indisposable Podcast, produced by Upstream and supported this season by Patagonia. I'm your host, Brookine Gatewood. Thanks for joining for another episode celebrating solutions to plastic pollution.
Hello, everybody. This episode with Marcus Erickson of Five Gyres was recorded in February of 2020, right before the world changed in a really big way. Because of that unfortunate timing, we've been sitting on it for months, and I wanted to put it out because it's a really rich conversation. Marcus is a very thoughtful and longtime leader in the plastic pollution movement, and his life story is all sorts of interesting adventures, which we get to hear a lot about in this episode. So this is a great sort of historic piece for those interested in the early days of the plastic pollution movement. And Five Gyres is doing a lot of great work to support the next generation of change makers. And we will be collaborating with them more in the future. We will be hearing updates about what that organization is up to in their own post-COVID pivot work. And in the meantime, please enjoy this interesting, introspective, entertaining, historical piece with Marcus Erickson. Hello, everybody. I'm here today with Marcus Erickson, who is one of the earliest leaders of the plastic pollution movement. And Marcus's story of how he got into this work is quite the adventure, literally. So we're going to ask him in this episode a little bit about the early days of the plastic pollution movement. And we're going to hear what he's up to now with Five Gyres, the nonprofit that he founded with his partner and wife, Anna Cummins. And Five Gyres focuses on empowering action through science, education, and adventure. So Marcus, thanks so much for joining us today and sharing a little bit about your story and all the work that you've witnessed and been involved in this movement over the last decade or so.
Well, thanks for having me on the podcast.
Yeah. So let's go to the beginning. So I always do a little research about the people I interview, and we've met, and I've known you for a number of years at this point, but I learned a lot in this research process and learned about some of your early adventures, building rafts, going down rivers, and then eventually across the ocean. So tell us a little bit about how you got started with these sort of Huck Finn kind of adventures.
Sure. I think if I had to start, I'd go back to actually the first Gulf War back in 1991. I was there in Kuwait. That's when the United States went into Kuwait City to liberate Kuwait from the Iraqi army. I was one of the Marines. I was on the ground among all those burning oil wells. You may recall from those years watching the news, seeing, you know, hundreds of oil wells on fire. I remember sitting there covered in oil, sitting in a foxhole and talking to a Marine next to me saying, you know, if we were to survive this, let's build a raft like Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn. And that thought, that discussion kind of took our minds off of the war around us. But I've actually reflected on that war quite a bit, the dependence that we have for fossil fuels, not just the energy, but the chemistry that comes from it, including plastics. Mm-hmm. But at that time, I was really just trying to take my mind off of the carnage I saw all around me. I made good on that promise. About 13 years later, I built a raft, and I just happened to use plastic bottles. I figured 232 2-liter plastic bottles would make an unsinkable raft. So I made this boat, and I was dropped off in Lake Itasca, Minnesota, way up north, and I didn't see New Orleans, my hometown, until 5 months later. But along that way, I mean, it was a pretty remarkable experience. I was able to reconnect with people, with nature, and I kind of lost sight of that between the Gulf War and that river trip on a plastic bottle raft. But it brought all that back to me, just
wow.
The beauty. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was inspiring. There's the beauty of nature around me and the goodness, the basic goodness of people and the joy of having intimate contact with nature. But then when I saw plastic trash drifting by, and I can tell you, I could never was there a moment I couldn't look up and not see some plastic trash. There's a bottle going by, a bottle cap, there's styrofoam on the bank of the river. There was all this trash going down this amazing river that drains all or part of 31 states, 42% of the United States flows down that river and knits this export of trash to the world's oceans. Mm. That's my introduction.
Yeah, and, you know, I grew up on the Mississippi and was just there a few months ago, marveling at the river. It's really, it's a wonder of the world that so few of us in this country ever really even visit, even though it runs right through the middle of things. But yeah, there's a lot of trash that runs down it as well, which is sad.
Yes, yes. And you know, because I spent so much time, I mean, I spent 5 months camping on the bank of the river. You create this relationship with nature and with people, you know, living close to the river, that now when I see trash in the river, in the ocean, it's personally offensive. It's like, why can't we do better than this to destroy something so beautiful? You know, so another side story is the joy of intimate contact with nature. You fall in love with nature and you feel destined to defend it. So soon after that river trip that I met Captain Charles Moore back in 2004, I actually put my river raft on a trailer, brought it from Louisiana where I grew up back to California where I was living. And I found Captain Charles Moore and I went to his house with my raft on a trailer and introduced myself.
So for those who don't know, who is Charles Moore? What's his role in this movement? You know,
he's recognized as discovering the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. He had sailed to Hawaii and was coming back with his big catamaran with twin diesels going right through the high pressure system of the gyre in the North Pacific. And he just saw this unending trail of trash. That was back in 1999. Mm-hmm. 5 years later is when I had finished my river trip. And I meet Charlie, and within 3 weeks, he says, "You know, can you come work with me?" So I ran their science education program for about 6 years and went into the gyre with Charlie twice. And that second trip in the gyre was when I had just met Anna Cummins. Now, Anna Cummins knew Charlie for years, and she was working on environmental policy. And I knew of her, and she knew of me. We had not met. And once we did, we began dating, and a few months later, find ourselves in the middle of the North Pacific Gyre on Charlie Moore's boat, the Algita. I knew she was the one. So I remember I saw some fishing line floating in the middle of the ocean. So I pulled it out. I cut a small piece. I made a ring. I found Anna sleeping on top of a pile of sails. And she woke up, and I proposed right there.
Wow.
I remember.
If this isn't an activist's idea of a romance story, I don't know what is.
it was pretty amazing. And I said, you don't have to answer now. We're in the middle of the ocean. You can wait. But she said yes. And that began this life mission to work together, to be together, but to work on this issue. Within a couple of years, we started the Five Gyres Institute. And then the mission was to answer some unanswered questions. At that time, you know, a decade ago, people didn't know where was the plastic in the world's oceans. They were beginning to hear about ocean plastics. They didn't know where it was, how much was there, what were the ecological impacts. So there were a lot of unanswered questions. So our initial mission was simply, okay, we've sailed with Charlie Moore. Let's go sailing around the world. We can charter boats. We can do the research. We can publish papers. We can launch campaigns, and we did. And we were so lucky to find the right people, Carolyn Box, Steve Wilson. We had all these amazing people very early on, part of Five Gyres, answering these questions and then launching the campaigns based on science. What do we do about this data, this abundance of trash, which we've now found is everywhere. Everywhere you look, the Arctic, Antarctic, the equator, all five subtropical gyres, everywhere we look, we find microplastics.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that to me is so distinct about Five Gyres is, you know, you do the science and the education about science, but you also have this adventure component that makes a lot of sense if you know you and Anna, and I know you biked around at the beginning doing a bike tour to help people understand the problem. And tell me about what the adventure part means to you and why you think it's an important aspect of your approach to the work.
You know, I'd have to go back to my youth growing up just outside New Orleans. I lived less than a mile from the Mississippi River and a couple miles from really virgin swampland, where I could walk down Veterans Highway, hop the levee, and catch alligators, snakes, and turtles all day long. That intimate connection to nature, it's steadying for me. I mean, I can think back to being in nature, and it's calming. I love being out in the wild, and it often takes, you know, an adventure to get there. So it's been integral to everything that I've done and what Anna and I have done together. You know, soon after meeting Anna, actually when I proposed to her, I remember saying, you know, will you marry me? She said yes. And I said, but how about we do this really big rafting adventure? And when I was proposing, after proposing, I proposed that we build the mega raft out of plastic bottles. And we did. And Anna was on board. Well, she was on board the project, not on board the raft. She had more sense than that. We took 15,000 plastic bottles and we wrapped them up with fishing nets, make giant pontoons, put those under a Cessna 310 aircraft that we found in a junkyard, and we called it a boat. We called it junk. And Anna was mission control. She was on land, constantly fundraising, giving weather reports, monitoring our drift as we drifted on this contraption from Los Angeles all the way to Hawaii. My co-navigator was a guy named Joel Pascal, an amazing sailor. He improved our design and made it seaworthy. It wasn't for him, we wouldn't have survived the trip. So Joel and I made it. We thought it might take us 3 weeks. It took us 3 months, 13 weeks to get from LA to Hawaii. And that was kind of our launching expedition for Five Gyres, was this big adventure. And, you know, I've thought about that trip thousands of times. You know, it was so calming. I'll tell you, there were moments where I'd sit there on the raft looking at the ocean, having been there for, you know, a couple months, just bobbing along, and I could sit and quietly count to 1,000, get to 999 and say, okay, I'll take a break. Now I can't count to 9 without getting distracted.
Yeah.
And nature does that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes me so curious about the contrast to those early days filled with a lot of adventure. And I know it's still part of what you do, and you're running an organization, and it's probably a lot more time at the computer, in the cities, traveling around, giving talks. And what do you do nowadays to keep yourself grounded and able to count beyond 9, as you said?
Meditate, do yoga. That's as close as I can get. But no, Anne and I, you know, soon after the junk raft, we did the junk ride. We rode our bicycles from Vancouver, Canada to Tijuana, Mexico. And that's where we met Steve Wilson, actually, in Portland, Oregon. And he was right in the middle of the plastic bag ban.
Mm-hmm.
And very soon after that we began Five Gyres, began our expeditions. And the idea was to sail around the world in little short legs. Our first one was from Bermuda all the way to the Azores, across the Atlantic. And actually, Steve Wilson, he joined us on that voyage. Soon after, Carolyn Box joined us. We had an amazing team of people. But we've now done about 20 of these expeditions. And it's not just the time in nature and the adventure and the joy, the exhilaration of a mission to get from point A to point B and accomplish something great. What's equally, if not more meaningful, is building relationships with the people that you're having these adventures with.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you how many times I've been on deck and look up at the stars, and I'm sharing that humility under this blanket of the universe with someone next to me, with my team of 4 or 5 people on watch, and we're just talking about this beauty. And then when we do our research midday, we drag our net across ocean surface, pick up the plastics. It's so much more meaningful to reflect on the beauty and the contrast with this ugliness of this waste. And to share that experience so many times with so many people in so many different places around the world, it creates so much meaning for my life, for our organization, that I miss it.
Mm.
I'm gonna be back at sea right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's pure joy.
Yeah, and you're also speaking to the importance of building meaningful relationships and, you know, the community of people who've been doing this activism work around plastic pollution are pretty deeply connected, which I think is part of the success, right? That there's real relationships driving the coordination required to do this complex work.
Yes, yes. And you guys have been a big part of that. I mean, meeting you, meeting Matt, meeting the upstream team, meeting Crystal Ambrose on board ship. She's from the Bahamas. She did amazing work there. I can list hundreds, probably 300 people have been with us at sea. And those relationships are integral to what a movement is. A movement isn't just this amorphous thing. It's thousands and thousands of interpersonal connections, all moving in the same direction, independently, but harmoniously. Mm-hmm. And that's what I like about Adventures at Sea, being out in the ocean, tying science to the activism, to the people. It just brings so much meaning and joy to the work. And the work's hard, as you know.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I know one of the other things you guys focus on is even more so nowadays is building the next generation of leaders. So tell us a little bit about your approach to that and some of the inspirational youth that you've gotten to work with at Five Gyres.
Sure. The first thing I would think of is me being in that position as a young scientist, meeting Charles Moore back in 2004. And the first thing he did, he said, if you want to research plastic pollution, read this. And he handed me 30 research papers, about 30. And that was pretty much all that was known about plastics in the ocean at the time. Now, if I did that, I'd hand somebody 3,000 papers. Mm-hmm. There's so much known. But there is this new generation of young people, young scientists, young activists, people that innovative entrepreneurs, people that want to go to the state capitol or to DC and work on policy. There is this generational movement. We've been around this long doing this work, that it's the role that Five Gyres is taking now with our history and our base of knowledge and the relationships we have with people is to connect, is to be a connector and to transfer what we've learned to this next generation. So they're starting where we've left off.
Mm. And you guys have worked with youth in India as well, right?
We have. So one great thing about the expeditions is that we tried to tie into them a gathering before and after. Before we take off, maybe there's a Two Oceans Aquarium in Cape Town or the aquarium in Charleston. Wherever we are, we try to find an institute that we can have a gathering of the minds. And then once we sail across an ocean, across a body of water, wherever we land, organize something there. And that's kind of how this movement kind of builds. We host youth summits in India and Delhi. We hosted several youth summits. Anna, co-founder of Five Gyres, my wife, she was working with Algalita to help them begin their first POP summit almost 10 years ago. So these summits, these youth summits, and that's kind of where Five Gyres is going to be focusing in the near future, is on this youth, on the youth movement, finding the people that want to do science, want to do policy, want to be activists, want to be innovators, and say, okay, here are all the tools that we have. Here's all the knowledge that we've garnered over the last couple decades, and it's all here, free. It's all open source. Take it, run with it, and let's change. Let's focus on where we can make changes in the world, and we'll give you the tools to do it.
Yeah. You know, one of the questions I have for you as one of the people who's seen this evolution from plastic pollution being an issue that very few people knew about or paid attention to, like you said, there were 30 papers on it when you started, to the explosion in the movement over the last couple of years. I'm kind of curious, what has surprised you the most about the progress that you've seen in your time working on this?
First thing comes to mind is the resilience of the movement, just to never give up. Mm-hmm. It's inspiring to see, you know, some of the same people have been at this for 10, 20 years, and they're just like us, and they're evolving into this mentorship role, and it's just meeting so many people that are in this for all the right reasons. They care so deeply about conservation and social justice. It is so inspiring. It further invigorates us to want to take on this role as mentors. At the same time, it's hard not to recognize the power of the status quo. to defend themselves. And the intelligence that goes behind the way they might try to unravel our campaigns, or the kinds of messaging that they use to appeal to the masses to undermine what we do. So those two camps, you've got the resilience of the movement and the power of the status quo that are continually at odds.
Yeah.
There's a great book I read by Roger Pilke, I think, called The Honest Broker.
Mm-hmm.
It's about how scientists position themselves. You've got lots of different kinds of scientists out there. And I can tell you from my personal experience is that as soon as I published a paper, things changed, perceptions changed. And I had this opportunity to engage with the private sector. I think as soon as corporate executives see you have a PhD, first of all, and then you've published a few papers, you're taken very seriously. You earn some credibility. But the role of the honest broker, I mean, there are scientists that are scientists for hire. There are scientists that do work because they're paid to do it, regardless if it undermines the credibility of the institution of science. I've seen those kinds of sleuth scientists out there.
Mm-hmm.
Then there are some scientists that will do the science they can get funded for. Then there are scientists that will do the science because they see the greater good. And they feel an obligation to do science because it supports a greater good. And that's a position where I'd like to think that I exist in. I feel that it's important for the movement to have good science. Otherwise, we could be spending our time, our resources, going down a rabbit hole that might not be the best place to use our resources.
Mm-hmm.
Science lets us focus. I think industry, the corporates need science also. As soon as there is some science, then they believe it. If you tell them there's plastic in the ocean, which I've been doing for 20 years, no one takes you seriously until you say, and here's a paper I published in Plus One that shows 5.25 trillion particles of plastic in the world's oceans. Then they stop and say, oh, okay. And you get some credibility and they listen. They'll give you the time of day to say, you know what, you've got to stop making that plastic packaging. Statistically, it is the biggest polluter in the world. Here's an alternative, the science behind some biomaterials, whatever the case may be. You've got to have good science. And when you do that, you sort of walk this fine line between those two camps, where the movement wants the science so that their campaigns are effective and very targeted and focused. And industry wants the science so they can make the best decisions about how they're going to spend their resources as well. If they're going to make a move, it's got to be backed by science, because their moves might cost, you know, $30, $40, $50 million to change packaging. They want the best science available. And that's been a unique role to take.
So tying in what you've been talking about in terms of the positioning of the scientist in this process, I'm curious what you see as the biggest risks or concerns for the community that's working on plastic pollution to be aware of in terms of the status quo interests. And what are you seeing as some of the most effective strategies? We're hoping to have an episode soon on preemption, for example, and what's going on in the policy space with all these different bans and banning the bans and all that. What are some of the trends that you're keeping an eye on in terms of the knee-jerk response to the new disruptive economy that we're trying to create here, where disposables are not part of the future?
What I see is what I would call this great divide. And I call it the Great Divide. It's between the circular economy thought leaders, which is largely the movement to end single-use plastics, and the linear economic status quo, which has been very good at making plastic on this one-way direction from extraction to production to eventual waste and the harm it causes to people and the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So that division, if you have that philosophy in your head that you're going to defend this linear economic system because it's too difficult to make those changes, you put so much capital money into making plastic a certain way, you have $1 billion invested in the machinery, you have markets around the world buying all your different kinds of plastics, different blends, to have this movement rise and to come in and say, you got to stop doing that. They could either invest billions more in doing it something different, or they can defend what they have. And you've got so many corporations on that fence, but leaning toward defending the status quo. That's why you see such focus on recycling, on the linear economy, on waste management, all this downstream, all this remediation speak.
Yeah. You know, I'm reminded of the story of interface carpet, which is a different industry but related problem, and the aha moment that Ray Anderson had recognizing that carpet didn't need to be a disposable product. It could be a service that has a, there's a whole business case for turning products into services, right? And we're seeing that with companies like Vessel, who I just did an interview with, and Cup Club, and all these different efforts to create more, you know, bringing back the milkman in a circular economy approach, which is service-based as opposed to product that becomes trash. And fundamentally, that's what we're going for. But as you're saying, it's also threatening to current business models, even though there's an alternative business model that could also work.
it's a huge division. There's the linear versus circular economy. There's the prevention versus remediation. And it's the same divide. It's the same two groups on opposite sides of this wall between us. And, you know, on our side, on the circular economic thought wall, I mean, it's like you said, Vessel, Cup Club, you have the alternative ways of delivering materials or delivering products, the innovative ways of packaging things. There's some room for biomaterials. There's the zero waste communities initiatives. I would say those three things, zero waste communities, alternative delivery means, and biomaterials, that's kind of our space.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side, you're seeing industries really doubling down. The Alliance to End Plastic Waste putting up close to $2 billion to push chemical recycling across Southeast Asia. They're really doubling down to push this narrative, not to bridge the wall, but rather make it make that wall higher.
So I'm also curious if you see from your history in this work, what are the mistakes that you've seen over time, or words of caution you might have for those carrying the work forward, particularly around this business sector piece that we've been talking about a little bit?
You know, I think it's very important to understand where we've come from, what we've learned, so we're not repeating some of the mistakes, or at least taking what we've learned in the past and building on that, building power on that. I think it's understanding, part of that is understanding the relationship that the early activists have had with industry. You know, in my engagement in the past with industry, with the ACC and others, now to see the Alliance to End Plastic Waste and others, they're much smarter and they know what they're doing. And for example, in the Philippines, I understand that they're pushing for well over 100 pyrolysis machines going to 100 villages across the country in small cities. And that is really in direct contrast to the zero waste work being done by Gaia, Mother Earth Foundation, and others. So I think it's important for the younger leaders entering this space to, you know, if you get a chance at a conference or at a meeting, to pull aside some of the folks who have been there for a long time and just ask them, where do you see this going? Where can you be more effective? What are some of the risks? Take them aside, have a conversation. You never know what you just might learn from them and their experience.
Mm. Yeah, and I'm also hearing that one of the challenges that comes with success is that the response starts paying attention more, you know, or the business side starts paying attention more and putting more resources in. The strategy gets more complex, right?
Yes. So $1.2 to $2 billion in Alliance on Plastic Waste is a big investment.
Yeah.
You know, when I think about how we engage the private sector, you know, again, it comes back to personal relationships. And all my expeditions, it's the personal connections that are more meaningful. When you meet CEOs, you know, C-suite leaders in companies, you're talking to people. And if you can find, especially privately held companies, where you can meet the CEO whose his or her family might still own the company, there you can talk about what really matters in the world. You can talk about the science of trash in the oceans, trash in our beach, trash being burned in communities. And you can say, look, I know it might be tough to do, but you're in a position to change this. And those kinds of relationships with corporate leaders in the private sector, I think can be powerful. They can be meaningful. And they can create some change if you get to the right person at the right time. And that's why I don't mind engaging with the private sector on some of these expeditions I've been on or some of these conferences. It's an important conversation. It creates the same kind of personal bonds that I've had with some folks at sea.
You know, I wanted to ask you about the ocean cleanup effort, and I think what you just said is a good chance to bring that up. It's a technology solution that a lot of people are excited about. When I talk to people who aren't involved in the movement, it's often one of the first questions I get about, what do you think of this ocean cleanup? Isn't that going to solve the problem? And I know in your Junkraft book, you had a whole chapter about why that's not the best approach. I'm wondering if you still have the same opinion, and if you just want to lay out your argument for those who might have that same question about, you know, what's the problem with the ocean cleanup approach?
Sure. You know, just for your audience, I'm sure they already know that the ocean cleanup, their effort was simply, you know, in the name of their organization, to clean up the ocean. If you tell a layperson there's trash in the oceans, their first thought is, well, go clean it up. Someone go get it. Someone pick up all those millions of tons of trash. But if you look at the science of ocean plastics, what we're learning, and most of my colleagues agree, is the ocean spits out trash pretty quick. If you look at the Japan tsunami 2011, within 7 years, 90% of the boats that were lost have come ashore. And so a lot of the ocean modelers now are saying, you know, what's out there is less than 1% of 1 year's production of plastics. It's 0.000032% of all plastic ever made. The ocean surface is not where it's at. But that narrative of cleanup, it's so powerful in the mind of the layperson that they would hear it. They'd throw their money at the organization. And, you know, I would say the ocean cleanup was kind of stuck. They took all this money, and some of it they took millions, I think 9 million from Salesforce. They got to make do on their promise. And they tried. They did not succeed. But they tried, and now they've moved to these river containment devices. But you know, if you look at their idea to remediate, to clean up, does it have a place? I would say marginally. I mean, there is a need to clean up Superfund sites around the world. But if you look at the history of how other issues have been solved, like the hole in the ozone layer, you know, and it's the same evolution of that issue. Hole in the ozone layer, tar floating on the ocean surface, or smog over big cities, like here in Los Angeles, where I am. Those issues, those three issues, they began with an initial science discovery, media outrage, and the public was saying, do something, do something. A lot of money went to science, and within a decade, scientists said, look, the ozone layer, you got to ban CFCs, preventative solution. You can't pump ozone and think you're going to fix it. Preventive solution. Tar on the ocean surface. Scientists said, look, you've got to stop ships from rinsing sludge out of their oil tankers into the ocean. And that was common practice back then. That ended, and things began to clean up. Smog over cities. Scientists said, you got to have emissions controls on cars, a preventative solution. And you had people saying, oh, just clean it up. One idea was to put filters on top of smoke, on top of skyscrapers to suck up air pollution. So you had all these weird cleanup ideas way back in the day. But those three big environmental issues were solved by a preventative strategy ultimately. Mm. Plastics, the same way. So ocean cleanup, you know, sure, a beach cleanup, you need to do that because the trash might wash back in the ocean. But if we're going to solve this problem, and at the biggest bang for the buck, it's got to be preventative. And my fear is that organizations are focused on cleanup. These remediation activities, they are harming the movement. They are taking time and resources away from all those other groups that really understand it's a preventative strategy. So while I would say, you know, cleanup, that's maybe 10% of the solution. Get out of the way of the folks that are doing the bulk of the work to prevent the problem in the first place.
Well, one of the things I wanted to close on is I was prepping for this conversation and I watched a little video that's on the Five Gyres website. If anybody's interested, of course, you want to check out fivegyres.org and the About Us page where you can learn more about Marcus and Anna's love story that created the organization. And there's this cute video of you guys on your early bike trip. And one of the things that really struck me was, you know, you were just getting started in this work at that point, and you said, you know, I feel like I have a chance to do something good here. And it just really moved me to see that and to see whatever we're at, 12, 15 years later, from that younger you with a big idea and a lot of drive to the impact you've gotten to participate in over time just by choosing to commit to this. So I just wanted to reflect back to you as a leader that I found that inspiring. And you're a great example of you just chose to dedicate a lot of your energy to this. And now you, I imagine, sleep pretty well at night feeling like you're really part of the solution.
And no regrets whatsoever. It's been such a great journey, and it really is defined by the people I've sailed side by side with, especially my wife, Anna Cummins.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Marcus, for taking the time to talk and share a little bit of your story. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
And that's our show. If you like what you're hearing, help spread the word. Subscribe to the Indisposable Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Add a review, talk us up. Nobody spreads a message like you. The Indisposable Podcast is brought to you by Upstream, sparking innovative solutions to plastic pollution, envisioning a world without it, and empowering businesses, communities, and individuals to imagine and co-create this future with us. You can find resources mentioned on today's episode, as well as learn more about Upstream's work at www.upstreamsolutions.org. Follow us on social and join the movement. There's a better way than throwaway.